We'll hear argument next in case number 19-267, Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Agnes Morrissey Beru and the consolidated case.
Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman. This week, we will discuss cases that the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this week involving the First Amendment and a doctrine known as the ministerial exception.
So, Holly, we were back at the Supreme Court this week, virtually.
That's right. That was nice. Getting used to it. And I can say I enjoy not having to get up so early to get in line to get in the courtroom.
You know, 2 weeks in a row to have two church-state cases, is that a first for you and in all your years at BJC to have these cases so close together?
I'm sure it is without going back and checking, because as we discussed earlier, this term is unique in the number of cases. And yes, it feels like back to back to back, not to mention that these are sandwiched in between other really important cases dealing with executive power and other important constitutional rights. So it's pretty exciting.
So this week, the Supreme Court heard argument in a pair of cases. These cases involve two elementary school teachers in two different Catholic schools in Southern California. Both teachers had been fired from their positions and they claimed illegal discrimination. One claimed that she was fired because of her age, the other because of a disability in that case because she had breast cancer. And in each case, the school asserted a doctrine called the ministerial exception, which says that employment discrimination laws, including Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, don't apply to the employment relationship between religious employers and their ministers. And I'm putting ministers in quotes because you don't have to be called a minister to get the ministerial exception. But we're going to talk a lot more about that. We've also already talked some about this back in episode 5 of Respecting Religion for our loyal listeners. And if you happen to miss that episode, you might want to go back and listen to it. We talked there kind of previewing these cases and as they related to a grouping of another closely watched and highly anticipated cases that involve the interpretation of Title VII. So just a reminder that we have covered some of this ground before.
Yes, clearly the employment relationship is an important to religious institutions as well as to the broader economic society. And so the court has these really important cases that may or may not kind of relate to each other. We'll see how they turn out. But at issue is under what circumstances can employees claim civil rights protections when they are fired or they're not hired or some employment action is taken against them, whether it is unlawful. So.
And the Supreme Court has taken up this issue before back in 2012 in a case called Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School versus EEOC, but it's often referred to just as Hosanna Tabor because that's quite a mouthful. And I'll say for our listeners, there's a lot of information about that prior case on our website at bjconline.org/Hosanna-Tabor, and we'll put a link in show notes to that. But Hosanna Tabor is a really important case. It was important to the argument that was heard this week, and important because it was the first time the Supreme Court recognized the existence of the ministerial exception doctrine. Lower courts around the country have been using it for some time, but the Supreme Court recognized it 8 years ago, and they did it unanimously, which Supreme Court doesn't act unanimously that often in church-state cases, in a 9-0 decision authored by Chief Justice Roberts. So what do we need to know about Hosanna Tabor and the ministerial exception?
Well, you've said the important part is that the court recognized this broad exemption, the ministerial exception, and did so by a 9-0 decision in a religious liberty case. And that just shows the importance and the solid ground that this exception stands on. I think the exception itself is worth talking about because it's a little bit hard to understand, or at least it's not expected all of the time. So the doctrine of ministerial exception had been recognized in lower courts for many years. And it is a rule that says that in the employment relationship between a religious employer and a minister, so a narrow category of employees, the court will not even consider the claim of the employee. Basically, broad discretion for the religious employer in a narrow class of employees. So with regard to a narrow class of employees, the ministerial exception is grounded in both clauses of the First Amendment. In Hosanna Tabor, the court said that by imposing an unwanted minister, the state infringes on the free exercise clause, which protects a religious group's right to shape its own faith and mission through its appointments, according to the state, the power to determine which individuals will minister to the faithful also violates the Establishment Clause, which prohibits government involvement in such ecclesiastical decisions. So that's the court recognizing that, unlike in some cases where there might be some tension between Establishment Clause concerns and Free Exercise Clause concerns that together serve religious liberty, here the interests of both clauses fit together to say the state, the government, should stay out of this relationship between religious institutions and their ministers.
I think some of this might be surprising to people who learn about the ministerial exception for the first time, because as you said, it grants such broad immunity from anti-discrimination laws. You know, so I think it's helpful to see how grounded it is in the First Amendment and how just 8 years ago, the Supreme Court did not find it controversial to affirm the existence of this doctrine and this protection for religious employers.
Yeah, I think when we say it's surprising, it's because we know that employment protections based on protected categories such as race and gender, national origin, age, all of these categories are important to make sure we have a fair society, right? And we like to think that religious institutions in particular care about a fair, equality-based society. But religious institutions also are in a position to advance religion. And so they have special needs, and the specialness of religion, the uniqueness of religion in our constitutional order deserves certain solicitude, as a court has used that term before. It deserves certain attention to make sure that religion flourishes on its own terms. And that's what the ministerial exception is about. In the Hosanna Tabor case, we were part of a brief with several other organizations and academic leaders in the field. And we said at the very outset that the ministerial exception was important because it was about the separation of church and state, that it was basically a core application of religious liberty, and that it was important for the court to recognize that the ministerial exception was grounded in the First Amendment and could be applied in that case. Our position in defense of the ministerial exception and wanting the court to find a ministerial exception in Hosanna Tabor is not because we don't care about employment protections in other environments and in other cases, but it's just because we wanted to stand strong on the principle that government should not be entangled in religious decisions about who serves in ministry, because it would necessarily entangle the courts in decisions about religious doctrine. That's the basis for the ministerial exception. It assumes that ministers, these leaders of the faith, play an essential role in formulating and carrying out religious doctrine, and that in those specific roles, the state really should not intervene. The state has very little interest in deciding who is involved, who will serve that function, who will play that leadership role. And we don't even want the courts to be asking the questions or involved in any way.
I think the state doesn't have much of an interest and is also very ill-equipped to be making those kind of calls. You know, when I talk about the Establishment Clause and separation of church and state, which is the doctrine that's supported by the way that the two clauses of the First Amendment work together, say, you know, the church shouldn't do the job of the state shouldn't do the job of the church. And when you have courts trying to make these calls about who should and should not be a minister, you start to tread dangerously in that direction of the state trying to do the job of the church. And I think the Supreme Court, again, 9-0, also felt uncomfortable in that Hosanna Tabor case in being the one to make that kind of a call.
It's important to note that the ministerial exception is just one particular protection for religious liberty. And I say particular because, as I mentioned, as we were talking about here, it only applies to the position of minister. There are other doctrines, other state laws and federal laws and exemptions to them, such as those in Title VII that allow religious entities to hire according to religion. So I want to just be clear about that. We're talking about a precise doctrine. And then, as we'll talk about today, the case deals with how far it extends.
And in Hosanna Tabor, the court made clear that it extends beyond people that we just traditionally think about as ministers, people who serve in a clergy role in a house of worship. Because in Hosanna Tabor, the plaintiff, the aggrieved employee in that case, was someone who was a teacher in a Lutheran school. So in that case, obviously, ministerial exception is a little bit misleading because she was not a what one normally thinks of as a minister. She was, in that case, a called teacher, which that particular school distinguished from other lay teachers. And she had other indicia of being set aside for ministry in some way. But the court really studiously avoided developing a hard test there. Instead, they said ministerial exception exists and that the teacher in this case was clearly within that definition of a minister for that purpose.
That's right. In the very first case that the Supreme Court recognized and upheld the constitutional basis for the ministerial exception, did so with a teacher in a Lutheran school. But it was a teacher, as you said, who had certain markers of specialness being ordained and her education and all that made that case easier than the one we'll talk about today.
And there was a concurrence in that case, one by Justice Thomas, who would have just deferred entirely to the school to determine who was a minister, wouldn't get involved in a test at all. And also a concurrence written by Justice Alito that was joined by Justice Kagan. You know, in rereading their concurrence, I noted that Justice Alito seemed particularly troubled by even the term ministerial exception. He said that that didn't really take into account minority religions that didn't use the word minister. Minister is generally used when talking about Christian and specifically Protestant Christian clergy. So he wanted to be sure that the court wasn't relying too much on labels and titles in this case, but said that it should apply to any employee who leads a religious organization, conducts religious worship services or important religious ceremonies or rituals, or serves as a messenger or teacher of its faith.
Yeah, remembering that that's a concurring opinion, you know, the majority had already held and said in Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion that the plaintiff in that case was a minister. And so the concurrence is provided to say, don't read the majority opinion too narrowly. You know, that the term minister doesn't depend on any particular fact. And it's interesting in the quote that you just read, reading it again, it makes you wonder if at the time Justice Alito was thinking about a situation like these new cases where the term minister might be applied very broadly to all the teachers in a Catholic school.
Well, and whether he was thinking about it at the time or not, those cases arrived at the Supreme Court. And so we'll take a quick break. And after the break, we'll look at the arguments that we heard this week and share some of those clips with you here.
We're back, and now we can talk about where the court left off in Hosanna Tabor, having recognized the ministerial exception and its application to a teacher, but rejecting the idea that there's a rigid formula as to how to define a minister. Now we are 8 years down the road, and the court takes up these cases where the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the ministerial exception did not apply to let these religious employers, these Catholic schools, out of these cases where teachers had sued saying that they had been terminated for discriminatory reasons. We don't need to talk a lot about the facts of these cases. The court didn't talk a lot about the facts of these cases because really it was reviewed on motions for summary judgment. That's or motions as a matter of law. And the court was really looking to see what is the proper test to be applied that would allow a religious employer to claim the exception and then sort of get out of court. But as I think we noted earlier, in one case, a teacher claimed that her contract was not renewed because of her age. She had been a teacher in the school for many years. And in another case, a teacher claimed that her contract was not renewed because she had recently told the school about her breast cancer and need for treatment. In both cases, the teachers are in elementary schools and they have some responsibility for teaching religion, along with many other responsibilities. They had some training, but nothing like the extensive nature of training that was recognized in the earlier teacher case, in the earlier Hosanna Tabor case, where the teacher had something like 8 hours of college level credit and an ordination process, sort of a certification process of a special ministry leadership. In this case, these teachers think the evidence was more akin to a day-long workshop and some training about how to use a workbook they would use to teach religion to their students.
And I think that those differences, just right out of the gate, kind of thinking about how the justices responded to this, I think my number one takeaway from the argument is I don't think this case is going to be unanimous. I think that broad consensus that we saw the court have in Hosanna Tabor in this much closer case when it involves these teachers who have less training, maybe spend less of their time doing religious instruction, don't have the same kind of title that sets them apart from other kinds of teachers in the schools, that many of the justices seemed concerned with the breadth of the ministerial exception as it applied in this case.
And one other thing, it's not just about the extra training that is not exhibited here. It was actually that there was questions about whether they were even required to be a member of the Catholic faith. And in one of the cases, the teacher said that she was not Catholic. And I think in the other case, she said that she didn't think there was a requirement that one be Catholic. And so that kind of added an extra element. Certainly that was not the case in Hosanna Tabor, where the teacher was an ordained teacher, a called teacher, separate from lay teachers. In this case, these are lay teachers. And so it presents quite a different set of facts to try to fit this ministerial exception onto.
And at least two of the justices, the Chief Justice and Justice Kagan, asked about that, trying to, again, discern some kind of, maybe discern additional factors or additional tests, but what to read into the fact that the person have to be the same member of the faith to be considered a minister in this case. And the advocates who were representing the schools in this case, the school and the government, said that even to get into that kind of inquiry was risking the kind of establishment clause problems that the ministerial exception is supposed to avoid.
Yeah, they were really saying that you must defer strongly to the religious employer to decide who is fit to be a minister, or in this case, to be a teacher that might be part of this ministerial exception. The courts below, in applying Hosanna Tabor, sort of summarized the court's opinion into these factors. And those factors were whether the employer held the employee out as a minister, whether the employee's title reflected ministerial substance and training, whether the employee held himself or herself out as a minister, and whether the employee's job duties included important religious functions. Well, it's really just that last point that the parties in this case agree upon. Both sides agreed that important religious functions was a necessary element of holding that someone is a minister, but that was about all they agreed upon, and they didn't agree on what would qualify as important religious function or who decides. And then the question is whether these other factors that weren't listed in a rigid test, were not even listed as four factors in Hosanna Tabor, are important to the decision of whether or not someone is a minister.
And you could see the justices kind of grappling here. You know, they said, we don't want to have a rigid test in Hosanna Tabor, and then you send it down to the circuit courts, and they're left with just one Supreme Court case to rely on as guidance when they're trying to decide these claims. And I want to play a clip here from Justice Breyer, where he's really asking for guidance from the advocates on how to write the opinion.
What advice can you give us? What should we write in these paragraphs? I can, you know, we could start by saying leadership or authority, but what else can we write that will, or what should we write to say guide the lower courts so they don't meddle too much?
As they were searching for a test, you could see that one of the concerns is just that they might develop a test that was too broad. Counsel for the religious institutions and for the federal government were arguing broadly that all that matters was the important religious function, that if the employee performed important religious functions, then they should be covered by the ministerial exception. And I remember Justice Kagan particularly was concerned even about how to quantify that, or how that could seem too broad and really capture many more employees than even she would like to see. And she had been in that concurring opinion with Justice Alito in the earlier case.
In some of your answers, you've talked a lot about the language in Hosanna Tabor, which was, you know, leading, preaching, teaching. But of course, Hosanna Tabor connected that up with the title, with the training, with the formal commissioning. And when you take all of those things away and you're just left with those terms, preaching and teaching, that's when you get into all the tricky questions, like how much preaching, how much teaching, of what kind, any prayer that you say during the day, any amount of teaching. So how would we deal with that?
And in response to Justice Kagan's question, the advocate from the Solicitor General's office said that the religious function just needed to be a meaningful part of someone's job duties.
Yeah, and I don't think that satisfied the justices. I don't think that gave much more meat to the test. And so we continue to hear them struggle with the issues in this case.
Yeah, so who decides what's meaningful? How much is meaningful? There's another approach here, and that is to just completely defer to the religious institutions and who they decide is a minister or not. That was the approach taken by Justice Thomas and his concurrence in Hosanna Tabor. And reading tea leaves from the argument, it looks like Justice Thomas might have Justice Gorsuch, who's on board with that, if this particular question he asked from argument is any indication.
Counsel, elsewhere in the First Amendment and under RFRA, we have emphasized repeatedly that we do not inquire into how important the plaintiff's religious belief is or how central it is to their faith. We protect any sincerely held religious belief precisely because we're afraid about entangling courts in making religious judgments and discriminating against minority religions that may have views about what's important that are unusual or different from our own. Here, however, it seems to me, instead of pursuing that line of argument and suggesting that the sincerely held religious belief about who is a minister should control, you're asking this court to involve itself in deciding for itself who is and who is not an important minister, or just a de minimis, I think is the words you've used, person. in the teaching of religion. Doesn't that create just exactly the sort of entanglement problems that we've tried to avoid elsewhere and discriminate potentially against minority religions that may have different views of ministers than you or I may have? And you reject all these hypotheticals as speculative or haven't yet arisen, but the very test you propose would seem to me to invite them.
Yeah, I found that question from Justice Gorsuch amazing because he appeared to go even farther than counsel for the religious schools did. And they had gone really far in asking the court to defer to them. But they were trying to be reasonable, as any good advocate should, to not look too greedy, to not look like you're going beyond what you could get or what you should be able to get. And yet, Justice Gorsuch said, hang on a minute, maybe you're giving up too much. That's what it sounded like. And just saying, why can't we defer to their sincere beliefs? Of course, that would really skew things toward the religious employer and doesn't take into account at all the understanding of the employee. Sure, that would be easier for courts, but easy is not what we're looking for. We also need the court to come up with something that is just, and the implications of that much deference are really problematic.
It's problematic because it really throws out of balance the weighing of rights that the court had gone to lengths to do in the Hosanna Tabor case. In the concluding paragraph of that opinion, Justice Roberts begins by pointing out how important it is to society that we enforce employment discrimination statutes. And he also acknowledges the interest of religious groups in choosing who will preach their beliefs, teach their faith, and carry out their mission, to quote the opinion. And in that case, they were able to balance those rights. If you give so much deference to the religious institution to decide always without any kind of involvement from the courts who their minister is, you're in some cases going to give short shrift, not just to the employees, but to the entire society's interest in enforcing employment discrimination statutes. And it's that point that we also heard justices weigh in on. Justice Ginsburg seemed very concerned not just about how broadly the ministerial exception would apply, but also the breadth of the exemption that is at play here.
And that's important because the argument was really on how many employees would be ministers and thus what the religious employer could sort of rely on. We don't have to worry about the court interfering in our employment relationships with these employees. And they weren't at all talking about the doctrine and what it does.
So let's hear what the justices had to say on this issue. And first we'll hear from Justice Ginsburg.
The breadth of the exemption is staggering. That is, these people are exempt from all anti-discrimination laws.
I remember at one point that breadth being a concern that Sotomayor asked about. And in that case, she really did get to the meaning of the exception and how it works in a way that would really take away employment rights broadly.
I think what's being confused here is that you're asking for an exception to law that's broader than the ministerial exception generally, and broader than is necessary to protect the church. The two teachers at issue here are not claiming that they were fired because the school thought they were teaching religion wrong. One says she was fired because she came down with cancer and was fired for a medical condition. The other claims it was because of age. She had been there for many, many years and had been very acceptable to the school, and all of a sudden she reaches a certain age and she's fired. So you're asking for an exception to the Family and Medical Leave Act, to wage and hourly laws, to all sorts of laws, including breach of contract, because at least one of the schools here, contract with the teacher says they won't discriminate because of the teacher's age or disability. So you're asking for something broader than giving the schools the power to hire or fire certain kinds of people because of how they teach the religion or don't teach it. And you haven't explained to me why it's necessary.
Justice Sotomayor's question really raises concerns about the doctrine and emphasizes the need for careful tailoring. I mean, she's raising the specter of widespread, invidious discrimination that none of us want to see. And that's certainly not what we are defending when we defend the ministerial exception, because we see the ministerial exception as really serving important purposes in safeguarding religious institutions and their autonomy with respect to the most important factors of leadership and governance. At the same time, we know that what it means is that it allows these religious institutions to be free from any claims of discrimination against ministerial employees on any basis whatsoever, race, disability, sex, and age. And the way I like to think about it is that we're not saying that religious institutions never behave badly or that discrimination is fine when religious institutions are doing it. What we're saying is that there are some questions that the civil courts do not have the power to answer. And that is includes the question of who is fit to be its ministers. That's a matter of church-state separation. And so now the court has the very difficult job of deciding and giving some guidance to the lower courts to protect that interest without harming all these other civil right interests that come up for employees.
I don't envy them. I think this is a really tough case to find out where that line is, because I do think there needs to be a line of some sort. The answer cannot be that every employee of a religious institution is a minister. Then the exception seems to swallow the rule in this case. And yet figuring out how to draw a line that doesn't entangle the court excessively in a religious institution's affairs is really difficult.
That's right.
So we will take a break and we'll come back to wrap up this week's episode. So for our last segment today, usually we talk about where else we saw religion respected in our world around us. This week, we saw things respecting religion and our work protecting religious liberty at the argument in these cases, in the Our Lady of Guadalupe cases this week. We saw things that implicated other cases that are being heard before the Supreme Court this year and other parts of our work.
We did. In addition to the issues that we've already talked about at play for deciding these particular cases, I noticed that the court also touched on a couple of other issues, including the role of religion in the public schools and also the role of religious institutions quite broadly, but specifically religious schools in society.
So on the first point, I sat up and took notice when Justice Thomas was questioning the advocate for the employees, and he asked him actually a couple of different questions that sounded kind of like gotcha questions. He said, you know, would this kind of instruction, the instruction that the teachers were giving in these religion classes or teaching religion in their regular classes to their elementary school kids, if they did that in the public schools, would we consider that an Establishment Clause violation? And when he asked the question the second time, he said, don't you think it's odd that they're doing it in the religious school, but if they did it in a public school, it would be an establishment violation. They're doing it in a private school. Shouldn't that get free exercise protection?
Yeah, it's kind of like, hey, this is something interesting to think about, but it was actually quite hard to figure out why it was relevant to the issue in the case.
Yeah, and the advocate didn't exactly address the question head on, and as a good advocate, kind of got back to the point that he was trying to make, I think, for his clients there. But, you know, on a little bit more reflection, I thought, you know, yeah, probably teaching religion in a devotional way, in a way where you're trying to proselytize perhaps to the kids in your class, that would be a problem for the Establishment Clause. We know that ever since those cases in the 1960s that were not to teach religion in a devotional way. But just because something would be overtly religious doesn't make someone a minister, which of course was the central issue at play in this case.
Yeah, and I guess the connection is that if you recognize that these religious schools are different, then you also recognize that the government should not interfere, should not interfere in the religious nature and the religious teaching. So there's the connection, but as you say, it's a whole step farther to then say that somehow would mean that any of the teachers are ministers and covered by the ministerial exception. Yeah, and that reminds me of the other part of the argument that touched on the role of religious institutions and particularly religious schools in society. At one point, Justice Alito was questioning one of the advocates, and he noted that that schools that are set up by religious bodies do so for the teaching of religion. He said that the teaching of religion in such schools is central. That's the very reason why these schools are set up, is what he said. He said otherwise there would be no reason the students could just go to the public school and not have to pay any tuition. So it's central to their mission. And the fact that it is done by an elementary school teacher, that the teaching of religion is done by an elementary school teacher who also teaches everything else, including religion, shouldn't really make a difference. And I think in that line of questioning, when Alito was saying that, he was, again, sort of leading toward a more expansive view of the ministerial exception that could apply broadly to all of the teachers in such schools. So it was interesting because in that line of questioning, he emphasized the distinct role of religious schools. And as we know, that topic has been discussed by the court in a very different case, the Espinoza case, in a case where the court will decide whether or not there's a free exercise right that requires state of Montana to include private religious schools in any kind of funding program that they set up that would apply to secular private schools. So religious schools are important. They are distinct. Their religiosity is central to their mission. And we know that that will require some limits on the government's involvement in them. Maybe not such limits that would extend the ministerial exception so far. We'll have to wait and see. And we will learn very soon whether that distinction is enough to allow states not to fund them on an equal par with their public schools or other private institutions.
We'll be watching for all of these opinions that are coming out in this blockbuster term. And we expect some of those decisions anytime now, particularly in that Espinoza case that you mentioned. That brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or earbuds during this time of social distancing. For additional resources on what we discussed today, including a link to the audio of this week's Supreme Court arguments, check out the show notes that go with this episode.
And tune in again next week. We release a new podcast in the series each Thursday. You can see a list of all of them on our website. Just visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And be sure to subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss any episodes. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill. And you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. And get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith, freedom for all since 1936.
And join us again for our next conversation, Respecting Religion.